Oh, my. Well, hi, everyone. I'm Karen. I am an alcoholic. It's been so long since I told my story. Outside of COVID, first time I told my story, I was 6 months sober. And you don't know shit when you're 6 months sober. And I didn't. And at my home group at the time, it was in Hershey, Pennsylvania, we had a guy, his name was Little Bob, and he was a little person, and he came into the rooms at the age of 24. And every time he spoke, I was just drawn to him because he spoke with such eloquence, and he just always had me. And then he asked me to speak, and I'm like, oh, God, right? So I said, I got to ask my sponsor, because I didn't know what to do. And my sponsor says, well, you always say yes to AA. If you don't have a commitment, you always say yes to AA. I'm like, okay. So she said, you're going to be fine. She said, let me help you, she said. She gave me a little piece of paper about this big with the word God written on it. And it was in blue ink with pink and yellow highlight. And she said, if you get nervous, which I am, she said, put it in your pocket. Well, 6 years ago, they made leggings without pockets. And I went, right? And so I had to do the meeting, and I needed to put God somewhere. So I stuck him in my bra. Biggest pocket I knew I had. So I went to the meeting, and Little Bob's there, and I'm chatting with him, and my sponsor came in, and she goes, you okay? You okay? Yeah, I'm fine. She goes, you got everything? And I'm going like this, looking for God, and I lost him. I mean, look at me. I can't lose him. So I said, excuse me. I ran into the bathroom, found God. I had to strip. I found God, and I adjusted him. So if you're wondering, God is in my pocket right next to my heart tonight. So just thought I'd tell you that. But, yeah. So my name is Karen. I am an alcoholic, and my sobriety date is March 15th, 2016. I have a sponsor, a new sponsor in my new hometown, and I've had sponsors. And I have also sponsored women as well. This is my home group. Hot Springs is my home group. And I also have a second home group, which I don't ordinarily do, but I love this group, and it's Sober on 140. It's a new group. So there's everybody there. So I would like to thank everyone for coming tonight, and I want to welcome the spouses and the significant others as well, because alcoholism is a family disease as well as an individual disease, and I think it's really important that family members are included. So I want to welcome all of you tonight. So about me, I was taught that when you're asked to speak, you tell them who you are, you tell them what happened, and you tell them where you are today. So I am a regular person. I grew up in suburbia in New York, in the state of New York. And my dad worked. My mom raised us. I have a younger sister, younger brother. My sister is my bestest friend in the whole wide world. I would die for her, and she would die for me. I mean, we just were that close. My brother walked away from my family about 30 years ago. And the only thing I know about him is that he is currently in active alcoholism. That's all I know. I keep in touch with his kids, but that's all I know. My sister is my rock. And I was just a regular kid, you know, stable family. Didn't have a lot of alcohol, in the family. But I grew up in the 60s and the 70s. And if any of you are from the 60s, when people were in corporate America, it was standard to have cocktail parties in your home. And everybody you worked with came to your cocktail parties. And my mom, who was French-Canadian, did not know how to speak English very well, so she taught herself through Julia Child. She taught herself how to be a gourmet chef. I know she can speak with English worth a darn, but... and she taught herself to be a mixologist. So when my parents would have cocktail parties, my sister and I would serve the cocktails to the guests. And I was about 12 years old, and this is my first taste of alcohol. And my mom said, take this to so-and-so. Okay, take it to so-and-so. And it was filled to the brim, and it spilt on my hand. So, you know, you got to sip it, okay, so you don't spill it when you're walking, right? It was the worst thing I ever tasted. It was the worst thing. But, oh my God, it hit my sensories like fireworks. It just tingled from the top of my head down to my toes, and I went, oh, I like this. You know, 12 years old, I like this. But that was it. That was the first time I ever really tasted a drink. And by the way, it was a Manhattan. I still didn't. Awful. Anyway, the point of the thing is I did not drink until I was about 17 years old. I was in high school, and I was a cheerleader, if you didn't think, you know, that's the way I am. I was a cheerleader. I was involved in all the sports. I did everything. And we went out to bars, whether we won or lost. We didn't care. We went out to bars. That's what we did. And I would start drinking mixed drinks. And it was okay. And I tossed a few back, and I would get a little lightheaded, and then I would go home. You know, that was it. And I went to college, and beer was these, you know, that was a drink everybody drank. I was in a sorority, so we drank like it was nobody's business. And I drank to get drunk, you know. It was fun. I was brave. I fit in. That's how I fit in. I did not know that's how I fit in. That's how I fit in. And then I had a choice to make: flunk out or quit. And so I quit college. And my dad said to me, well, you were not born with a silver spoon in your mouth, and you're getting your butt out to work. So that's what I did. I started working in corporate America. And I worked in corporate America for a really, really long time. In the 70s, and my dad, well, shortly after that, after I quit school, my father passed away. Very quickly, very unexpected, he died of leukemia. We found out the day before my sister got married, and he was buried the following Friday. I was 21 years old, and my dad was my rock. When I lost him, I lost my rock. And but my friends, they took me out partying, and I did that. I went to the clubs, the dance clubs, and I drank a lot, you know. I met my husband at a club. We worked for the same company. We worked for the same company. We met at a picnic, but we ended up hooking up at the club. But that was in 80. In 81, we got married. We married 41 years. Hardest job I ever had. And I say it, and I don't say it to criticize. I say it because relationships are hard. They're very hard, especially for this alcoholic. Relationships are really, really hard. So we got married, still married. We have two kids. My daughter lives in New Hampshire, and our son lives here in Canton, which is the reason why we moved here. And most of you know who I am, but we just moved here at the end of March. I love it. I love this area. This is great. And everybody I've met is just wonderful. But when we were married and had little ones, I was the helicopter mom. Now, I did not know what a helicopter mom was. I had to Google it, okay? But that is so me. I was into everything, right? Super mom, super wife, soccer mom, gym mom, hockey mom, worked 1, 2, 3 jobs all at the same time. I mean, that's just how we lived our lives. It was rush, 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 and I did everything. And I thought I was really good at it, but I was reminded that I wasn't. And I started to drink a little bit more. I did not go out to drink. I never really drank in bars. It was too expensive, and I didn't want anybody to tell me what I could and could not do. My kids grew up, and I lost my purpose. You know who I was, you know? I was still working, and now I have to be a wife with no kids, with no distractions. And I don't know if anybody who are empty nesters, that's huge. That's a really big change. Because kids were my escape from having an argument with my husband. I could blame my kids. I could do things for my kids and I could separate. Now my kids are gone and I gotta talk to him. And that was hard because I suck at relationships. I am terrible at it, you know. And we come from two very different backgrounds. He's Italian from New York City. Whole different animal by itself, right? And his family is like gigundous, okay? I got five in the United States. The rest of them are in Canada, and I don't even know their names because they can't speak English. So, I mean, we were just so, so different. And we demanded things from each other we couldn't give. And that made things really, really hard for us. I mean, our marriage has been a battle for many, many years. And my drinking escalated. And I will tell you, my husband is here, and he will feel like this. Yeah, she's right. She's hitting him up. She's hitting it. And if you ask him, he's going to say, yeah, she was right. Because it's the truth. It is. But my drinking escalated, and I found myself drinking on the job, drinking when I drove to work, drinking when I drove from work, drinking at lunch. I drank as much as I could drink before he would get home from work so I could black out. That's a pretty sick puppy, you know, but that's what I did. I ended up having two rehabs in my life. And a DUI. And you'd have thought that would have sent a signal that I was in trouble. But I ignored it. And I lived in denial for a really, really long time. My husband knew I was alcoholic, and every time he would tell me, I would ignore him, and I would hate him even more. And that's the truth of it. One time we had a fight. We were going somewhere and we had a fight, and I got so ticked off. Jumped out of the car when we were at a traffic light. I know you don't think I would do something like that, but I didn't. I did. And I went walking to my girlfriend's house, which was like 7 or 8 miles from where we were at, but I didn't care because I could walk it off because I had a buzz. And I was walking over this bridge, which happened to be over an expressway, and I stopped and I was watching the traffic. That's all I was doing, nothing more. And somebody saw me and called the police because they thought I was going to jump. You know? And so I see the cops coming, right? And I got a purse full of wine. I knew I'm intoxicated, and the last thing I wanted to do was deal with a cop. And I climbed over the guardrail, slipped in the snow, fell 40 feet down the ravine. And the cops, and the firemen, and the ambulance, it was like a parade. They all came, and they drug my butt up the hill. And the cop said, you got a choice. The hospital or jail? I said, no, I'm fine. Really, I can go home. I'm fine. No, you have a choice. The hospital or jail? So I figured I'd take the lesser of two evils. I went to the hospital. Only thing I remember about that night after that was laying in the ER, having x-rays. The next thing that happened, I woke up the next morning, and there's my husband in the corner of my portion of the room looking at me like this. And a doctor comes in, and he says, Mrs. Greco, he said, you took a pretty bad fall. And I said, really? And he says, you fractured your back. Mm. What? And my brain went, I'll fix this. No problem. Got it covered. I'll fix it. And the doctor laughed. My husband looked at me and he goes, what the hell are you doing? Do you not see what you're doing? And I could not answer him. I could not answer him. I didn't know what to say. I really didn't know what to say. So I end up going to rehab a couple times. Got my DUI. Thought I'd get my butt out of trouble with a DUI by going to rehab. And you usually, and it happened the first time as well. 2 months after rehab, I was drinking again. And the night that that I hit my absolute bottom, my husband and I had a horrible fight. I mean, it was the worst of worst. Now, my kids are gone. They're gone. My son is married. My daughter's in New York City working. They're gone. And it's just him and I. And we had a battle like it was nobody's business. He got so mad at me. He took all the phones out of the house. So I couldn't make a phone call. Couldn't call anybody. But he forgot a phone. And I knew which phone he forgot. So I picked it up and I threatened to call 911. And I did. And they picked up the phone and they went, 911. And I froze. And I hung up the phone. Then he said something that made me even more mad. So I picked it back up again and called him again. But nothing came out of my mouth and I hung up the phone. 15 minutes later, 3 state troopers pull up my driveway. I can't do anything little. It's got to be big. So the stateies pull up. He comes home. He had taken off in a frenzy. He came back. Cops cars everywhere. The neighbors are watching. I'm like, oh, my God. And this young cop says to me, Mrs. Greco, you've had a little bit too much to drink. And I think at that point I was just so tired. I just was done, you know. And he says, I think you need help. And you really need to stop drinking. And he says, you should go to AA. Now, I was in AA a couple of times, but it wasn't for me because I was an alcoholic. It wasn't me. I wasn't an alcoholic. Because I had a picture of what an alcoholic was, and it wasn't me. And my husband was told to pack a bag and to stay in a hotel that night. And he did. And I remember sitting on my living room floor with this glass of wine that never emptied. Never emptied. And I just realized I just didn't want to be there anymore. I mean, there were many times when I was drinking that I just wanted to end my life. I just wanted to disappear. I didn't want to deal with anything. I just didn't. But I loved my kids so much. I loved my husband. I knew it was wrong to die. That was it. I knew it was wrong to die. And I went and I prayed. The only person I knew how to pray. I looked up to the ceiling of my living room and my God, you have got to help me. I can't do this anymore. I don't want to do this anymore. And the next day, my husband came home. I don't even remember if I went to work. I don't think I did because I was pretty sick. Just before all of this, I began to recognize, and I will say I did recognize that my body was deteriorating. My organs were not functioning correctly. I could not put 2 words together and sound the slightest bit intelligent. I had no memory. So I knew something was wrong. Did I attribute it to alcohol? No, I did not. I didn't want to. But I knew something was wrong with me. So I don't remember if I went to work that day, but my husband came home and I said, I'm going to an AA meeting tonight and you're staying home. Because any other time, he would take me. But no, he was staying home because if I was going to do this, I was going to do this. I'm kind of strong-willed. And I fix myself. That's just how I roll. So I walk in this meeting in Hershey. There must have been about 30 people there. And I was like I was telling Wayne earlier tonight, when I first walked in, I just wanted to blend in with the walls. I wanted nobody to see me, nobody to talk to me. I just did not didn't want to be seen. I was ashamed. I was mad. I was brokenhearted. And I did not want anybody to pity me. And so I just, if I blended in with the wall, nobody would, it wouldn't matter, you know. But no, AA women are not like that. AA women come up to you and shake your hand and hug you whether you're crying or not. They just do that. And you're like, just get away from me. I don't want to talk to anybody. You know, it took all my strength to take my eyes from the floor to look them in the face. You know, my head was still sloshing. I could just feel it. I could feel it just moving in my head. Every time I turned my head, it hurt because I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to die. And this young lady, she was 27 years old, younger than my daughter, she says to me, she goes, you okay? I said, nope. And she said, well, she said, my name's Casey. And she said, you want to talk? We'll talk. Okay, fine. Meeting gets started, and I just sat in the back of the room. So at the end of the meeting, she came over to me. Now, if you're a retread, you know, you come into the rooms a couple of times, you know you have to have a sponsor, right? So you know that's drummed in your head, you got to get a sponsor. So I knew I had to get a sponsor. I did not want a sponsor because I'm the kind of person, do not tell me what to do. But I was so beaten that I knew I needed help. And that meant I had to get a sponsor. So I just resigned myself to the simple fact, I'm going to get help. And means getting a sponsor means getting a sponsor. So I did. I said, yeah. I said, I need a sponsor. I had no idea what her length of sobriety was. I didn't care. I just needed somebody to help me. And she had had a little more than a year at that time. And so she said, okay. She said, call me tomorrow night. She gave me a time. And I said, well, am I supposed to do something? Just call me. Just check in with me. Let me know how you're doing. She said, you might feel a little bit better. Take a couple of aspirin. You know, take the day off. You might feel better. All right. I went to work the next day. I was so sick. I had the DTs shaking. It was awful. I didn't know how I was going to get through the day. I honestly didn't. But I didn't think of a drink. Is that strange or what? I did not think of a drink. I just knew I felt so freaking bad. I was a mess. So I went to work that day. The next day was a Friday, and I went to work. I felt a little bit better, not a whole lot, but still a little bit better. I wasn't shaking so much. Then I went to the meeting, and she said, hi, how you doing? I went, all right. So she hands me a big book. I think it's my third big book in my lifetime already. Because, you know, the first couple of times, didn't read. The first time I read it, didn't understand it, so I gave that away to Goodwill. And then the second one I got, I gave to Goodwill because I wasn't going to carry a big book like that. My book, look at the size of my book now. Big letters because my eyes aren't so good. So she gives me a big book, and she sets up a time, and I'm going to do the steps with her once a week for an hour, hour and a half. I would go to her house, and we would go through the big book. And I'm okay. I'm going to meetings 5 days a week, sometimes twice a day, because I needed to. And then it was just every day, once a day. And I did that for a year. I went to a meeting 5 days a week. Oh, I never 7 days a week. Oh, mine was 5 days. 5 days a week, and for a whole year, I went to a meeting. I went to a big book study meeting, and then the home group that I belonged to at the time, we had literature, we had 12 and 12, and we had newcomer meetings, and that's how I got my sobriety. Third day, I'm in the rooms, my grand sponsor, who ended up being my sponsor the balance of the time I was in Hershey, says, you need a service commitment. Okay. I went and I sat down. I didn't know what a service commitment was. No. You're going to greet every person that walks through that door. I didn't know these people. I could barely remember my own name I'm supposed to be greeting. Oh, great. And I did that for a year. Every person that walks through that door, if I didn't know them, I stuck my hand out and said, hi, my name's Karen. Welcome to Hershey. And I did that for a year. And it was one of the greatest things I could do. Then I get involved, not because I volunteered, but because my sponsor and grand sponsor thought it would be good for me to get involved with the PA State Convention. And I ended up chairing four different chairs, one year at a time. I did it. Greatest experience I had. I learned 12 traditions by working service work with AA. I went to rehabs, and I shared my story at rehabs, sponsored people in rehabs. And what I found was, I found out that Karen is really a pretty special individual. Because, you know, most of my life, I always felt a step behind everybody else. Everybody else, especially the women, especially the girls, they were pretty. And I always wanted to be one of the pretty girls, and I never was. I never felt like I was one of the pretty girls, you know? I just never could cut it. And that's not on them. That was on me. And I did not realize that until I walked into AA and was taught that it wasn't them, it was me. I was my own worst enemy. You know, I learned when I did my step 4 and 5, and I had to identify the people who harmed me. And I had, when I had to do my step 4, this is what my sponsor told me, because I have a tendency of elaborating, right? Instead of saying the cat fell off the roof, the cat with the 9 stripes and the blue eyes and, you know, had the hot feet fell off the roof. I kind of elaborate. So she said to me, this is what I want you to do when you do your 4th step. You identify the people who hurt you. You can only write 2 sentences about the event. Because I found that when I wrote elaborated sentences, I relived that pain, and it intensified, and I got madder, and I couldn't let go. But if I kept it short and sweet to the point, it was easier for me to look at without so much emotion. And I thought, my goodness, why didn't anybody teach you this before? You know? And I found, and I was told this, and it is so true. You can get your point across in 10 words. You hit that 11th word and everybody's asleep. Yeah. Really, if you think about it, if you're direct and you say what you got to say in 10 words, you get their person's attention. When you elaborate, you get snoozeville. I did not know that. I learned that by doing my 4th step. Then I had to do my 5th step, and I have to talk about the event, and I had to describe the event. And I'm not going to say I was afraid. I was embarrassed, and I was ashamed, because here I saw it on paper, the event, how I felt, and my reaction. And you got to read it out loud. Well, by then, I'm like, I don't even want to read this out loud. I don't want to say this. I know. I got it. So I did have my 5th step with my young sponsor. And I thought it was thorough. First time I did my 4th step, I thought it was thorough. Come to find out, it wasn't. Because I do 4 steps a lot. Is it because I remember now things that I should have remembered? Probably. Was it part of a blackout? Could have been. Stuff I had stuffed way, way down and forgot about? Probably. But I don't worry about a step 4 anymore. I look forward to the step 4 today. I have the courage to do it today. I didn't in early sobriety. It bothered me greatly, because I did not want to recognize myself as an alcoholic. Nobody wants to call themselves an alcoholic. Nobody. But the simple fact of the matter is I am. I learned about what alcoholism was. spiritual, physical, and mental. I understand the concept of the disease. When I would drink, I would lighten the mood by drinking wine coolers, okay? Because they didn't have so much wine in them. The alcohol level was less, right? But I would drink a whole bunch of that just to get to the maximum level. I mean, that's just crazy. But that's what I did, you know? I fooled myself. I would tell myself that if I drank lightly, I wasn't an alcoholic. And the simple fact of the matter is, it's not what I drank, it's how I drank. I drank it alcoholically. I did not put the glass down. I have no off switch when it comes to booze. Did not like knowing that. But that's what happened. That's what I found out about myself, you know? 5, 6, 7, and 8. Oh, 8. The amends. Ooh, that's hard. Especially when it comes to family. You know, I kind of separated in my brain my amends, my family, my friends, and all others. And all others I did first. Because it didn't matter. It didn't matter to me anymore. If they didn't like me, they didn't like me. Not a whole lot I could do about it. I could say I was wrong. How could I fix it? How could I... And they had the opportunity of saying, I don't want to talk to you ever again, or don't worry about it, just get well. Okay? That didn't hurt so much. The friends that I associated with, most of those friends said, it's okay, Karen. We know you're sick. And just keep doing what you have to do to get well. And I had one that said, I don't ever want to see you, hear from you ever again. The damage you did was irreparable. At first, I went, oh, she just doesn't get it. And I thought, that was really dumb. Not working my program when I act like that. But that's how she felt, and I had to respect it. I had to respect it. Apparently, I didn't matter that much to her, which is okay. And I've moved on. And I learned from it. I learned from it. And that's all that matters. I learned from it. Because not everybody's going to believe me. The hardest amends is my husband and my children. That's the hardest. The rest of the family, the sister-in-laws, all of that, you know, they forgave me. They moved on. Although you can always tell they got one eye open, like, I wonder if she's going to fall back. You know? I always wonder, she okay? I don't really care. Made my amends to them. They seem to be all right with it. But my husband, my daughter, and my son, they were there when I was an active drinker. They saw me get arrested. They saw me go to rehab. They got the letters from me. They were there trying to help me when I ignored them. And that was the hardest part. So my amends to them is being sober every day today, being their friend, their confidant, their advisor, their parent, and to be a sound mind. That's my responsibility. And that's all they want from me. You know, my husband, he just wants not a crazy wife. You know, that's all he really wants. I don't know if I can do that. I'm still crazy. I am. And he's just as crazy. So and our house is really busy sometimes. Working my 10, 11, and 12, I pray every day. Not everybody can. I remember somebody told me once, if I could go in a snowstorm to buy a bottle of booze or a box of wine, I can certainly get my lazy butt out of bed, get on my knees, and say my prayers. It's all choice. All choice. Do I want to have a relationship with my higher power or don't I? And so for 6 years, 4:30 in the morning, I am up for an hour saying my prayers I learned in church, saying the prayers I learned in here, and having a conversation with God, telling him how I feel. I put this meeting in his hands, so if I blow it, it's on him, not me. You know? And that's what I do every day. When we moved down here, we had to move a home that we lived in for 40 years. And the hardest part of the move was the last 3 months, because my husband didn't pack his stuff. He's a procrastinator. But some way, God helped the two of us get it done. He helped us get it done. We packed what we kept in our in a U-Haul van, and we were so blessed. The guys in AA, God bless you guys, you can move furniture like it's nobody's business. They had my house packed in the truck in 2 hours, I'm telling you. You know, they were great. And then we drove down. We had a friend from Albany, and he drove the truck down. And whatever bump we would have experienced was minute, because God saw his way to make it an easy transition for us. When we got here, he made it easy for us to get the furniture into, the furniture from a house, you know, not all the furniture because it's in storage too, but the furniture we were keeping into our apartment easily. And we set up our home without killing each other, which is huge because we're very different. We're very different. Helped us to get into our home, our new town, okay? People welcomed us. People were nice to us. And moves like that are not always easy. They're not always easy, especially if it's not God's plan. If we push our way, and I learned this, if I push my way to get what I want, I work harder, things don't ever go my way. But if I ask God for help every day and stay in tune with him, my changes are not hard. They're just not hard. My life is, I'm not going to say stress-free, but my life is peaceful. Even when things are not good, even when I hit that Grand Canyon of crap, I can climb it without fear, without hate. Because as a drunk, I hated this world. I hated everything because nothing was easy. Everything was hard. And now, my goodness, AA just blessed me with so many gifts, so many gifts. Like I said, I put this meeting in God's hands. Because if I don't go by his direction, I'm a walking disaster. But if I let him lead the way, I'm very cool with it. I really am. And things are so much easier. The one thing I worry more when I'm sharing or even telling my story is being able to sound intelligent and to be able to relate what I have to say. Okay? I conceited. All right, I'm conceited. You know, that's just it. I want to be good. I want to present well. But when I start putting situations like that in God's hands, I don't have to worry about it because it just happens the way it's supposed to happen, and I'm okay with that. And when my mind goes blank, that's God telling me to shut my mouth. I'm done. I'm okay with that too, because I can go on. I really can go on. So what are the gifts this program has given me? I have two beautiful grandchildren. We do not know that their grandmother is a drunk. I would say was, but I know was, it is. I'm just not actively drinking, and I'm sober. I work a good sober plan. My grandchildren, they ignite my life. My son likes me again. Actually, he really loves me, and he told me that he was proud of me. After I was such a monster, he was proud of me. And my daughter, you know, mothers and daughters have very different relationships than mothers and sons. And, you know, sometimes as a mother, I wanted her to be really friendly with me, but I cannot be my children's friend. I have to be my children's parent, which is very different, you know. But I can be kind, and I am always honest. Does she like my honesty? Oh, no. No, because she has her own mindset, and that's okay, too. But she values my opinion now. Okay, I'm important to her now. And I wasn't for a really long time. She was afraid of me. And that's an awful feeling when your children are afraid of you. And my daughter was afraid of me. And now we have a good mother-daughter relationship. We can talk friendly, and we can talk mother-daughter, which is really great. My marriage is better. I don't believe any marriage is perfect because we're not perfect. I certainly am not perfect. I have to face that fact every single day. And fortunately, my husband's in Al-Anon. He's been in Al-Anon as long as I've been in AA. I went to Al-Anon for a while, but I found that I was too busy focusing on his program and not mine. I was not allowing myself to grow as an individual by being in Al-Anon. I think Al-Anon is one of the greatest programs for families of alcoholics. But as an alcoholic, I need to be in AA. I need to be in AA. How am I going to an Al-Anon meeting or a convention? I read their material. I've done Al-Anon Step 4, their workbook. And there's a lot to be said about what families of alcoholics feel, what they go through. And even in our big book, To the Wives and the Family Afterward, those are two chapters that are not really focused on, and they are so crucially important. They were vitally important to my healing with my family. Vitally important. And but him going to Al-Anon really helps him. He's not an alcoholic. He can have one or two beers. He can, I mean, Monday night is margarita night at the complex we live in, okay? And I know he's going to be down and miss you. He'll probably miss his Al-Anon meeting, but the thing about it is, I don't have a problem with that. He missed it the last time, let me tell you that, okay? Came home a little flush, you know. It is what it is, but the point of the matter is, he can shut it off. And there's lots of times that he doesn't have, I mean, he'll have beer in the house, but he doesn't drink it. It's not his go-to, you know? It's just not his go-to. And that's a good thing for him, because alcoholics need people who are Al-Anon. They really do. They really help each other out. But not saying that. That's what saved our marriage, most of us working together on our isms. And we have to work at it every day. I have to work on my sobriety every day. And when I was thinking about my talk, I went through the big book, and there's a chapter in the big book called Women Suffer Too. And I highlighted this session because this is me. And I did not realize this was me. My inability to accept harsh realities of life had resulted in a disillusioned cynic clothed in a protective armor against the world's misunderstanding. That armor had turned into prison walls, locking me in loneliness and fear. All I had was an iron determination to live my own life in spite of the alien world. And here I was, an inwardly frightened, outwardly defiant woman who desperately needed a prop to keep going. Alcohol was that prop, and I didn't see how I could live without it. That was me for a really long time. Today, And I wrote this in early sobriety, and it remains the same. Recovery is a journey, not a destination. If I tell myself I am recovered and have arrived, I feel like I have shortchanged myself. It would mean I am no longer open to new discoveries of myself and or of life. But if I am in constant state of recovery, I am open to new learning, to learning new things and having new experiences. I don't want my journey to end. If it ends, I tend to stop working. If I stop working, I stop learning. If I stop learning, I will fall back into old habits. And for me, that will bring death. That will bring death. And I will leave you with this. My hope for all of you is that I might have said something that has helped at least one of you. And this is my theology. I think about this every day. God's gift to me and to you is your life. What you do with your life is how you give back to God. As an alcoholic in recovery, God gave me a second chance at life by bringing me to the rooms of AA. And my gift back to God is what I give back. My name's Karen, and I am an alcoholic. Thank you for letting me share.